I'd proudly like to announce my first sponsor. Sagebrush Wisdom is brought to you by Windward Westward, a community of folks seeking deeper relationship with the natural world and richer conversations around the table. In addition to their gear, articles, and potluck dinner, this year they would like to introduce their first wild food subscription box. It is called the Wild Harvest Box, and it is a quarterly assortment of seasonal ingredients sourced straight from the wild and delivered to your home. Inside every Wild Harvest Box will be things like bison meat from the Great Plains, wild picked berries, wild forage mushrooms, wild caught fish, and more. Use promo code SAGEBRUSH and get a 3-pound bison chuck roast added to your first order. To learn more about the Windward Westward community, or to subscribe to get the best wild food delivered to your door, please visit windward-westward.com. Hello and welcome to Sagebrush Wisdom. Today, I have Brad Thompson on the podcast. He is a Southern California native who has hunted Western big game and fished basically his whole life, and now can happily claim that spearfishing has changed his life. As a result, Brad decided to lead the local spearfishing club, OC Spearos, for about 4 years, bringing insight, safety, fishing knowledge, and encouragement to many divers, especially new ones. I was very impressed with Brad's outlook on the outdoors for all, as he spends a lot of time helping others, but also his personal wisdom to slow down. It reminded me of the wisdom found in Stoicism and how you can apply that to your personal and outdoor life. Brad shares with us some awesome adventures, great strategy, and lots of wisdom for how the outdoors have shaped him in his own life. I hope you enjoy.
Good.
All right.
I'm sorry.
That's okay.
All righty. You ready?
Yeah. All good.
Okay. All right. Well, hello and welcome to Sagebrush Wisdom. Today, I have my friend Brad Thompson here. It is Thompson, right?
Yeah.
I don't know why. I have my friend Brad Thompson here today with me, and we're going to be talking about a lot of fun stuff. I'm excited for you to hear more about his life adventures, and I'm excited to be back. It's been a little bit of time since I've been podcasting, about a month, so I think we're all kind of waiting for the fish to bite, and we're all kind of just in this limbo land of not knowing what to do.
Strangest summer ever. It just keeps not being summer.
I know. It finally got sunny here, and the water won't warm up, even though they're saying it's El Nino, but I don't.
Yeah, we're finally got a few weeks of steadily over 60 degrees, which is just in pure insanity for this time of year. It's just crazy.
So, Brad, can you give me a rough rundown of all the hobbies that you do in the outdoor space?
Yeah, so the main thing I do is spearfishing. And then I do some hook and line fishing, like usually if I have friends from out of town or if my dad wants to go out with us or something, we'll go hook and line. But mostly it's spearfishing. And then I bow hunt and rifle hunt as well during the fall and winter.
When did you get involved with these activities? Like when did you start and what did you start with?
Well, it's funny. So I would say that my first passion was fishing, hook and line fishing, but I never really was able to do it. I would watch on the weekends, the fishing shows on cable, and I'd get the Bass Pro Shops catalog and save all my money and buy lures and buy stuff. But I never really had the opportunity to go. So I had all this gear, but I could never really go. So although the first passion really was fishing, the thing that I started being able to do the most was hunting. Mm-hmm. And my grandfather was a big game hunter out here in the West. He's originally from New York, but he moved out here with his brother, and they hunted Colorado every year. So mule deer and elk up in Colorado. So I think my first hunt with him, I was probably 12 or 13 years old. And I shot both a mule deer and a cow elk that year. And he just, you know, he was a cattle rancher. Well, he was a retired fireman. And by, you know, that time he was retired and he owned a cattle ranch. And so I was up working the ranch with him during summers, you know, just out there romping around in the dirt and shooting guns and
being a kid.
Being a kid. Yeah, being a kid, exactly. So
did you, you grew up here though, right?
Yeah, so
Southern California. And
yeah, so I was born here in Southern California and only moved out of Southern California for college. I went to school up in Oregon and then came back and I've been here my whole life. So yeah.
Were you, when you're a little kid, 12, 13 years old, were you like one of the few people that you ever met in your age group that had hunted for anything?
Oh, I never even, it wasn't something you would talk about. And it wasn't like I was trying to hide it or anything. Like I was ashamed of it or that, it, you know, I wasn't able to talk. It was just never crossed my mind to talk about it with anybody else. Like, you know, 'cause at that time we were living in Costa Mesa. And so, you know, that would have been in what, the early 90s. So there was just, there was nobody around that did that. It was never even a topic that would come up.
Yeah.
So yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. It was just me.
Did you, when you came back, it sounded like you spent a lot of your summers in Colorado, but did you,
well, no,
you
so we hunted in the fall and winter in Colorado. His ranch was also here in California.
Okay. Yeah, perfect. So, yeah. Perfect. Did you start going on, sport boats as a kid, as a teenager, or no. What was your like fishing outlet?
Yeah. So my dad's best friend, he's a guy named Ray. He always had big boats. So like his first boat was a, what was it? A 42 Bertram, and he kept it down in Dana and it bounced between Dana and, in San Diego. And so pretty much every weekend we were out on that fishing. And that started, I was probably, I would say 15 or 16 when we started doing that. And then, so he got rid of the Hatteras and he, or the Bertram, and he got a Hatteras, got rid of the Hatteras, got a Viking. And then the Viking moved down to Cabo. And so we were fishing out of Cabo, every 4 to 6 weeks, just, you know, for several years.
Yeah.
And then when I moved to Oregon, you know, I didn't really do any, you know, any blue water fishing there. We did some river fishing, but never any blue water fishing.
Where'd you go to school?
It was a little school called Willamette. It's in Salem, Oregon, in the right across the street from the Capitol.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
It's funny because I went to school in Seattle, and I obviously, it's a very different experience in the Pacific Northwest. Did you ever think about staying there, or did you?
I couldn't. I think I still to this day will maintain that the months of May to early October, the Pacific Northwest, I mean, I've traveled the entire world. I mean, everywhere. And the Pacific Northwest, May to October, like early October, is the most beautiful place on the planet. 100%. I love it.
Yeah.
But October through April, I couldn't do it. It was just, you know, I remember there was a year, it was probably like 2000, I think. That it rained every single day for 5 months and not real rain like we have here, just that like
misty,
little bit more than a drizzle, a little bit less than a rain, never saw blue skies. And it was like the day after I walked for, graduation, but the day before graduation, I had my truck and the U-Haul packed up. The day after graduation, you know, I walked, I was driving back here and never looked back. I mean, I think if I had the money and the ability to do it, I could probably have some sort of house up there for like a summer house. But no, I couldn't. Couldn't do it.
There's something that always appeals to me though, of, I have said this a couple times, I think, but if I wanted to, or if I had started duck hunting, I think when I lived in Seattle, it would have been a lot different. I think I would have maybe stayed up there a little bit longer. I have a good friend who lives up there, and he had asked me to go like elk hunting with him, but elk hunting was like too far away from what I knew. You know, like
it's all coastal jungle hunting basically.
Totally. Yeah. And it's just like one of those weird things where I was like, I mean, this sounds very adventurous, but I don't have any knowledge of how to do any of this. Like, I didn't grow up with somebody being like, all right, here we go, big game hunting.
Yeah.
You know, now I like can't wait to go back up and do some exploring with him.
but it's like I actually know what an elk looks like. And I know that that sounds dumb, but like I think a lot of people grow up and they're like, I don't even know what an elk.
How is an
elk any different from a deer?
Not just that. People don't really understand. Like I try to put into context because you know my girlfriend and my daughter, mm-hmm. neither of them have ever been up close and personal with probably deer, just seeing them around, but never an elk.
Yeah,
they just don't understand how big that animal is.
Uh-huh.
You try to put it into context. You say, okay, picture a horse. All right, picturing a horse. Picture bigger than a horse. Yeah. Because that's what a bull elk is. it's funny. I think I can really relate to that. So what you were saying about, starting hunting in the Northwest. And I don't know what it was. When I was in college, I think I focused more on, girls and booze and, college mm-hmm. life. And although I would fly fish like on the Willamette, the Santee Am, the Mackenzie, like the mm-hmm. Rogue, all those up there, a lot. I never hunted when I was in college. I just mm-hmm. I never did, and then it was so I stopped before I went, and then once I graduated, I started back up again.
Mm-hmm. Have you ever done any waterfowl hunting?
No, and I'm scared to because my time is already obsession. So thin. I'm like, no more obsessions, like. it's the same reason why I've never swung a golf club in my life. Yeah. It's like there, you have to limit it. You can only be so focused on so many things.
Yeah. I totally, it's one of those things that just the amount of stuff I have in my garage is enough.
Oh, I've seen the spreads, like the decoy spreads and stuff. And it's like, no, you should see my house. I mean, I have an entire bedroom in my house that is dedicated to hunting and diving, and you can't walk in it. Like I have this little pathway that I know how to get through in this bedroom that just all the stuff. So to add one more, I couldn't do it.
Mm-hmm.
Couldn't do it.
Well, the one thing that I really like about you, Brad, is the amount of experience that you have without the ego of it.
It has a lot to do with where we are. And it has a lot to do with your first question or one of your early questions of, did you ever have anybody to talk to it about? Mm-hmm. And other than my grandpa, I didn't.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that having outdoor hobbies, whatever they may be, whether, you're hiking or hunting or, mm-hmm. Whatever. I mean, I do like the harvesting aspect of outdoor activities. I think that they're really important, but you just have to have it. And here, where we live, it's so hard to find anybody else that does it. And B, most of the people that do it are really secretive about it because, mm-hmm. Hunters and fishermen are. They're secretive.
Right.
I don't think that helps anybody. So that's not going to help anybody get into it. And I know spearfishing, I went through a pretty hard time in my life, financially and relationship-wise, and spearfishing saved me from all that.
Mm-hmm.
So there's no way that I want to keep that to myself because somebody else may need that information. And so that's why I'm such an open... that's why I teach. That's why, because I want people to have this experience, not just of, it is cool. I think it is a really important thing to mm-hmm. harvest your own food. Not all of it, obviously, but to harvest a portion of your food and have the respect for what you did and the time that you put into it and for that animal and bringing it home. I think that's a big growing thing that can help people's lives. It's for sure helped mine. But, I really want to be able to be that person that anybody can ask a question and I'm never going to,
mm-hmm.
I'll never look down at them for it. I mean, I may bust balls here and there, but only in fun. And then I'll always put my arm around him afterwards and be like, "No, here it is. Come on, let's go over here and talk about it. Like, I'll help you out." Yeah.
Well, it is hard. It's like one of those things that I think a lot of people want to try some of these activities because it does look really cool, but also they might not understand the actual physicality of, hey, if you want to go bluefin diving after bluefin tuna, you're going to have to do a lot of preparation.
Yeah, don't.
Don't. Yeah. And, but people see that and they it's like them wanting to surf Jaws or climb Mount Everest.
It's exactly what it is. Yeah. I mean, I got into spearfishing because like I said, I was hook and line fishing forever and I've caught a lot of big fish. If I never caught a marlin again, I'd be super happy. Don't want to do it. And I saw the Terry Moss book, right? The Guide to Blue Water Hunting. And I don't even know where I saw it, but I immediately bought it.
Mm-hmm.
And it was that picture of him on the cover coming up with that giant tuna. And I'm like, ooh, I'm going to do that.
Yeah.
So I went in, head first, just went right into it. I we've tried so hard not to put the pun in there that I will not say that I dove in head first.
Yeah.
I just went, you know, I went whole hog into it, and but I was alone.
Yeah.
I had nobody to do it with. You know, my brother, I hunt with, he's the pretty much the only person I hunt with now, but he had moved to Arizona. So I was diving alone. You know, and I got pretty proficient at diving and spearfishing. And one day, I was somewhere up in Palos Verdes and it was probably the best day I've ever had diving.
Mm-hmm.
And, I got the, you know, after one dive, I came up and I'm like, what the heck am I doing? Like, I'm just coming up with all this on my own. I need to go like figure something out. So it was right about that time. I found the, you know, my dive club. Through the dive club, I found FII.
Mm-hmm.
So I took an FII course, and that really changed everything for me. And immediately at that point, I decided that I wanted to become an instructor for FII. So it took me like 3 years to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that all goes to say that, like, you're right. There's not like a community, at least a large one that's easy to find, like where you can go out and learn how to do these things. You know, mm-hmm. just hopping on YouTube and watching any Joe Schmo dive down and shoot a fish doesn't give you the full picture mm-hmm. of what, you know, spearfishing is. And so I try my best to be, you know, an open book to help anybody out who has a question and, you know, mm-hmm. no judgment, and try to give the best answers I can.
Yeah. And obviously it's not one of those things like when you're saying like, oh, don't do it. It's like, you're not trying to shut the door on people and say like, oh no, I've done it, but you can't do it. It's one of those interesting things that there is a lot of, I guess, the rubber hits the road at a certain point, and you really have to be ready beyond what you thought, you know, and like,
yeah,
you're saying,
big game fishermen. Hunting, big game hunting in the water is,
yeah.
It's no joke. Like,
yeah.
There's only been, in the water, there's only been one time I thought I was going to die. Like I really thought like, oh, here it is. And it was on a bluefin. And it was the first bluefin I ever shot. And it was for that same thing. Like there's nobody out there, or there's not a lot of information out there that says, okay, this is how you go hunt bluefin. I've killed big fish. You know, I've killed, you know, big yellowtail. I've killed big grouper.
Mm-hmm.
And that first bluefin I shot was only 30 pounds. It was a little guy, you know, football basically is bluefin
right.
standards. And I didn't treat him the way that now I know you have to treat him. And so basically what I had shot him and he was still hot. And I don't know, like pull in a hot yellowtail all the time, right?
Yeah.
Pulled in this bluefin, did the same thing I would have done to a 30-pound yellowtail, grabbed him by the tail, thinking I was going to shove him between my legs, pinch him off and stab him in the head, right? Like that's what I thought I was going to do. Grab this thing by the tail and it shook me like I've never been shook before. And just, I got stunned and let go. And so I have a 65-inch rear handle gun that I use.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a triple wrap on it with cable. And that, as soon as he swam away, he circled my right leg 3 times with that cable. And then, you know, thank God he didn't do what tunas normally do and swim down.
Yeah.
He swam flat. And so I'm tangled and he's dragging me through the water. And I was breaking my own rules. I was, you know, like you get tuna fever and I was by myself. I didn't have a dive buddy with me. So mm-hmm. I'm being drug alone. And in my head, I'm thinking, oh, all he's got to do is turn down and I'm toast. You know, I can't cut this cable off. And luckily I was able to keep my cool. I got myself untangled and it was fine. But I mean, that being said, it's like you can't go out and, you know, it's akin to saying, well, you know, I ran a 5K this week and I'm going to Kona and I'm doing the Ironman tomorrow. Like you just like, yes, go hunt tuna, but pay your dues and not even pay your dues in the way like, you know, be cool. Not that, like learn, spend time, treat it with respect. It's the same thing with, you know, like you could go to any, like high fence ranch and shoot whatever you want. Like, oh, okay. But then that doesn't mean that you're going to go on a backcountry archery hunt for elk next year.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
it's like, you know, just put in your time,
yeah.
learn and, you know, like just know that that all of this outdoor stuff, it's a lifelong journey. You got to treat it that way.
A couple years ago, I started thinking about how you obviously want to do all these amazing things. You know, you watch some guy surf halfway across the world and get a 45 second barrel or, you know, surf jaws or pipeline or anything. And it's like, then you see a pro, like Owen Wilson was a pro is a pro surfer, but like he fell at pipeline and just about ended his life, mm-hmm. broke his back, had to like recover for forever, you know? And you're like, wait, so if that happened to him, where would I have been in that situation?
Yeah.
And I think it's just like a very interesting thing. Like some of these things look so easy, and then you realize how we don't, I mean, there really is no context to say like, oh yeah, you're in unlimited water in the middle of nowhere. Like even if that fish swam a certain way and then you got hit by your own shaft, mm-hmm. like what are you going to do?
Yeah.
You know, you don't really know how to prepare for it.
Well, so it's not even that. Like, even like, and so, okay, what's the answer? Well, on the YouTube video, put a disclaimer up front. But that still doesn't even put it into perspective.
Yeah.
You know, because until you're in that, I mean, I've had a couple, you know, experiences in my life where it was when I'm busting my brother's chops. You know, I'll say things like, "Is this gonna be the thing that kills you?" Like joking, right? There's been a couple times when I ask myself, "Is this gonna be the thing that kills me?"
Yeah.
You know, like I'm right there on the knife's edge, you know, like, yeah. And, so it's a, you know, when you do these sports and when you do these, you know, particularly outdoor activities, when you're getting into like the more extreme end of things, it's just recognizing that you're getting there, mm-hmm. and just, you know, to do everything that you can and slow down, you know, like that's what I've really learned with, spearing and like backcountry hunting and stuff like that is mm-hmm. just slow down, yeah. like just like slow everything down, think, like use your head. That's how humans became the pinnacle species, right? Not because we have the best fur, or the longest talons, or the sharpest teeth. We've got the best brains. Slow down and use it. You know, like
I've said this to my friends before, and I'm actually surprised at how many people don't know this. But like in basic brain science, when you get nervous, your frontal lobe stops working, and then you go and start thinking with your lizard brain, all that stuff. And it's just really funny because I'll say that and it's like, well, that's why you can't remember anything. That's why you can't remember like if your pin was on the 40 pin or the 20 pin or
right.
the, not even looking through your peep sight or, you know, whatever it is.
Yeah.
And they're just like, I just blacked out. And you're yep. like, this is exactly the moment when you're not supposed to black out. You yep. know, instead of disconnecting to some degree, you're supposed to dive deeper and yeah. connect more.
You slow you down. Know? But and a lot of that comes with like living your life that way, doing it over and over again, practice.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like I've sent a lot of bad shots downrange, you know, when I was younger.
Yeah.
And you just learn from it.
Yeah.
And you just learn how to slow everything down and treat what you're doing with respect. You know, ultimately I like to think of like if I'm on, you know, whether I didn't even know it was a term until I started spearfishing, but whether I'm land hunting or spearfishing or whatever, you know, where was I going with that? It was, it was basically just the slow down.
Yeah. I think, being in the water and being in the land, it's like, you have a lot of decisions to make. You know, and you do have to make them very quickly sometimes. You know, if you're in the land, I think a lot of people, ducks are obviously a little bit different because they're flying. But if you wait a little bit in duck hunting, those ducks might fly by you once. And if you just stay completely still, there's a high likelihood they're going to come down and land. You know,
all animals are like that.
Totally.
You know, if you keep yourself off of the hunter pose and you slow yourself down and you relax, they're going to come. I mean, just what was it? I was doing the Neptune's tournament. I think it was 2 weeks ago or something. And we hopped in on this spot and my gun, it was the first spot of the day. First time I jumped in the water and it was a 4-band gun, the Oceanborn. And I hopped in the water and gun was completely unloaded. And I put my mask down, and the school of yellowtail comes swimming right in front of me.
Mm-hmm.
So instead of freaking out and, like, you know, trying to go crazy with the gun, I just went slow and didn't stare at him, didn't, you know, kept relaxed like I was just something in the water. Got one band on, Mm-hmm. Got the other band on. But by this time, you know, they'd gone behind me and I didn't turn around on them.
Yeah.
And out of my periphery, I see them coming like this. And now I'm like, geez, I don't have my slip tip on yet. So I'm sitting there shaking a little bit. So like, slow down. And I got the slip tip on and I tucked it away and then just slowly reached out and bam, got my yellowtail. Like, yeah. You know, they gave me a chance and I wasn't ready, but just with the experience of not freaking out and just slowing the F down.
Yeah.
I created the opportunity again for myself. Yeah.
It is wild. Like, I guess I haven't really ever thought about this, but I think every single yellowtail I've ever been a part of hunting, you know, on a paddy has been a multiple pass experience, you know? And when you are faced, like last year I dove in on a paddy and sometimes it doesn't work out. Like this fish and I were kind of having a stare down. It was like right under the kelp and I was trying to get it to play with me and like, not looking at it, but like diving around it and like just trying to, but it was like on home guard, you know? So I was like, okay, like it's probably 15 feet away, but I don't have like a double wrap gun. So I just, I'm like, I can't shoot that far, you know? And turns around and swims the other way, you know? Dang it. Like, well, that's that. But a lot of times we've jumped in on a paddy, seen yellowtail, got back in the boat, come back 10 minutes later, jump back in, the fish are back, and then you're ready. Like, then you're, like, calm and prepared you know, whatever. And it's just pretty wild of, like, there is a time. Like, I think spearfishing actually, for me, it was really helpful because it has given me a place to shoot a lot without having that real ramification of, like, oh, that was, like, a great buck that I just passed up. It's like, it's a yellowtail.
There's going to be
like,
more.
There's going to be a lot more.
Yeah.
With, I think, land hunting, as you're saying, there's a lot less opportunity.
For sure. Yeah, for sure. And I've noticed, like, to your point on that, like trying to play with the yellowtail and keeping off the hunt, like one of the biggest things I learned spearfishing, and that is it dramatically changed things for me, especially like in the white sea bass season. Is, you know, the hunter pose, right? Like eliminating that from your body. And okay, well, how do you do that? It's like, well, first thing is slow down. Okay. And then once you think you're going slow, slow down even more. And then what you start doing is like, I'll pay attention to the bait fish that are around me. How are they reacting to me? Are they scared of me? Well, if they're scared of you, everything's going to be scared of you, you know? So it's like, you start getting yourself into a pose and trying to practice, different ways of holding your body, different, and honestly, like different mindsets until you can get those bait fish to just be cool and hang out near you. Once you have that, now you're in the zone and now you're going to be, you know, a whole heck of a lot more successful than when you're swimming through, like kicking through or like even tension. Like I'll do the thing. There was I have a military friend who was telling me, you know, when we're out in the weird places and we need to find a sleep. He's like, I'll start at the top of my head and I'll work all the way down to my toes, taking inventory of every muscle, relaxing it, and then starting over from the top down, relaxing to fall asleep. Well, that works in the water too.
Oh, 100%.
You know, you start taking inventory of your muscles and you'll find muscles that you didn't even know were tensed. And once you start, you know, relaxing all those, next thing you know, those fish, you'll dramatically start finding that those fish are going to hang out and come and be curious of you, not scared of you.
Yeah. I used to dive a lot with GoPro and it's so funny to watch somebody who's actually shooting fish because you can watch their video and you don't
it's not like that.
For me, it was like one second there, second, and back and forth all over the place. And I just, it was such a good thing for me to see how fast I was observing things.
Yeah.
You know, too fast for you to actually see if there was a fish there or not, and how much vibration or whatever you want to call it you're making in the water is very noticed.
Sure.
You know?
Yeah. Their lateral lines are super strong. It's how they see the world.
Yeah.
You know, and if you're tense and splashing around or doing all kinds, they're just not going to come by.
Yeah.
They're just not.
Yeah.
So, it's same as land hunting, you know, like if you're out there crashing through unless you're, you know, you're hunting moose or something like that. But if you're out there crashing around, you know, nothing's going to want to be near you.
Yeah. I know it's always one of those touchy things, but we talk about it all the time, and with expectations and just like how badly you want something and how badly you're putting that energy out, you know, to make something work, to force something to work. Obviously, like, I think hunting has changed since, you know, 1,000 years ago, 2,000 years ago. Like, we don't normally need food.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now it's for sport, not for necessity.
We're doing it for sport. And so that basic idea of like, you know, I have a bunch of food in my backpack right now. If I get this animal, that's awesome. That is a lot of food. You know, I could obviously go to a grocery store. I can even order elk online now. You know, it's not that dire of like, oh, I need this. But when you change your expectations and you, I think, are like, why can somebody in Yellowstone walk up to an animal and be like, hey, elk, what are you doing? And then you in your Sitka camo with your bow in hand or whatever, it's the same animal. Literally, like, walk from one place to the other.
Yeah.
But for that, that interaction, it's almost like you're like, should I just be wearing blue jeans and a t-shirt? Like,
I mean, yeah, I stopped wearing camo a while ago, but for no other reason than I realized once you start learning how to use terrain and wind and the environment to your advantage, you don't really need the camo, you know. Yeah. Like, so I don't know. If people want to buy it, that's fine. That's great. If part of the sport is the gear, then yeah, that's cool. Like, mm-hmm. go ahead. But I just find I don't need it. Like, I just don't. I'd rather save the money, you know, because it's always what, like 10-15% upcharge to have.
Oh, 100%. I have noticed Giannis Patelis has said this, where it's like, if you're thinking about gear versus a trip, go on a trip. There's right. nothing that's going to help you more than being out there.
Right.
And if you can pay for one more trip to go scout before you go somewhere versus that one new pair of pants or jacket or something, I'm always like, okay, if I've hunted before, like, why do I need a new jacket?
Right. Right.
Is it really going to change my experience if, like, I move from this camo to that camo?
Yeah, no.
No. If I can make it, if I can stay dry, if I can stay warm, which I have a ton of, like, snowboarding gear, like, I have all that stuff. So, you know, ultimately, I'm like, I haven't been cold in a long, long time.
Yeah.
You know, and even if I am, it might only be for a couple minutes, and it's like, okay, I have extra socks in the car or something, you know, something yeah. to be prepared. Well, like, a duck doesn't care if you're wearing merino wool or you're wearing,
they don't care, you're Costco, you're in your blind or... anyway. Yeah. Yeah. No. Yeah. I'm I don't know. I mean, use what works, right? And I guess maybe if you don't understand how to use the environment to your advantage, maybe learn, but B, yeah, maybe it's a helpful, like, mm-hmm. Band-Aid, but just know that it's a Band-Aid.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What has it been like for you who have grown up in the hunting world a lot more than people mostly in Southern California to see, like, the rise of hunting down here kind of become more popular?
Good and bad. Good for obvious reasons. I do think that it's important for people in general just to be more connected to our land. And, you know, mm-hmm. we do have some of the best natural resources in the world here in the United States. And so I think it's cool that people are finding it bad, because freaking point creep, man. Mm-hmm. I've been 100% draw odds in Wyoming for the past 3 years, and I didn't draw again this year. Stupid point creeps kill me. I drew 0 tags this year, and I put it in 4 states, no tags. And so I'll be helping friends this year. But yeah, no, I think it's cool. I really do. It's just, I think it's an important part of life that people have forgotten about. Mm-hmm. You know, and it's good. It, for me, it's good to have quiet I think that's why I like, you know, especially backcountry hunting and spearfishing, because there's nobody in my ear. You're able to pick a singular task and focus on that task alone. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of people need that. Like, it's really, really helpful. And so hunting can give you that.
It was funny because for the last couple of years, I've been really on the fence for big game hunting, because I was just like, I don't have time. Like, Zach has a boat. We want to catch fish. Like, we want to be like, I don't want to be spending all my time scouting when I should be fishing, because, you know, technically I could get a lot more fish than I could get a deer, you know, for the same amount of effort of how many times you're going out there, how many times can you actually get something? It's like you get one deer or two deer maybe in California, and then it's like, but I can go out on a day and get five Dorado, you know.
You know, I think that's where community comes in. Yeah. You know, I'm in a really good situation with my brother where he's like the expert hunter, right? Like, so he puts in the time, like he dials in his e-scouting, then he goes and verifies with proper scouting, then, you know, like, so he's 100% dialed into the hunt, whereas I'm 100% dialed into spear. So we both get the benefit of each other's work in the off season, or during season, where like I'll call Jeff, he lives in Arizona, and I'll call Jeff and I'll say, hey man, bluefin are in town, hop in your truck, and he'll come out. And so he'll get the benefit of my expertise here.
Yeah.
Whereas when it comes time to be putting in, for hunting season, he'll be like, okay, so last year, this, that, or, you know, he told me, he's like, hey, Wyoming had a 60% mortality rate, with the snows, you know, like, we're going to, these are things that I don't have time because I'm doing the other stuff. So that's just a long way of saying, you know, build a community, you know, have friends and people around that you can bounce off of and share the load of the scouting of the, you know, whatever. It's just, so you can't, there's no way to do it all.
In my friend circle, I feel like I have all the duck decoys and I am willing to know, like, I'll spend in my free time as much time as possible to know when a duck is going to come by, where they're going to be, what blind, what marsh, what place in California, whatever. And it's like, okay, if you want to go this weekend, this is where we're going to go. And that's like my specialty, right? But then I have some friends that are super into deer hunting, and I'm like, I'll take you duck hunting.
Yeah.
If I can go along with you to go deer hunting.
It's perfect. You know, that's the way to do it.
Yeah.
It's 100% the way to do it. Unless you want to be like a specialist, unless you want to be a deer hunter and a deer hunter alone, then there is enough time in the day to do it all.
Yeah.
But if you want to spear and you want to duck hunt and you want to fly fish and you want a big game hunt, like, you can't.
No.
And so the hack is like what you're doing. That's great. Yeah. You know, go out there, find groups, find like the Windward Westward, you know, the Quail Club, find places like that. You know, that's how I got into spear fishing, you know, was building a community through the OC Spearos.
Mm-hmm.
I never would have been able to get as far as I've gotten in the sport without, you know, not just finding friends that I can use to get information from, because I never looked at it like that. You know, within 6 months of joining the club, I was telling them, I want to take a lot from this club. I want to learn. What can I do to give back? Well, within 6 months, I was on the board.
Mm-hmm.
And then I ended up basically running the club for close to 4 years, you know, and in that time, you know, club did a lot of great things. So not only was I taking from the club, but I was giving back, because there's always going to be somebody new coming up that's never done anything in the sport before and needs that help. So it's like, you know, you give and you take, and it's the only way that it can be done.
Totally. Yeah. I mean, OC Spearos was such a good example, because, you know, you could have no experience at all and get the proper like class on medical assistance on a boat, or how to dive for lobster with this technique, or, you know, whatever it was. It was always like every time you went there, you were learning something and then meeting people who were like-minded. And so I've always wanted to like have an arm of that where, you know, it's an open book for anybody. You know, I try to be as open as I can, but I think that there are a lot of experts, and there's like, if you want to talk about gear, like, I know a little bit, but I can point you in the right direction for like, this is the person you want to talk to.
Yeah.
If you know, you want a specialty spear gun, or you want a better rifle, or, you know, this or that. It's like, I can start the conversation, but I can't.
But you're just describing again, community. Like you're saying, like you've got it right on the nose.
Yeah.
You know, nobody can do it alone, particularly not here, not in Southern California. Yeah. There's just not enough people around that do it.
Well, I also think, like, as far as land hunting goes, it's just one of those things, like, we're still so far away. And it's not just, like you're saying, it's not just far away miles-wise. It's culture-wise. Mm-hmm. So you being able to be, like, all in about deer hunting is just one of those things, like, it's such a balance, but it's like you don't then ever have much more of a community. It's just you, because you're the one person in your whole friend group that does it.
Yeah.
And so you just sit there and you're like kind of upset with the world because you're like, ah, like.
Yeah, but you can easily fix that. And, you know, I think a lot of the local groups, whether it's, you know, the spearfishing or the hunting groups around, are doing a good job of it, but like just being ethically minded when they're doing it. You know, I've met a lot of people around here that when you say you're a hunter, they have this stigma in, you know, in their mind where they think, they picture like some redneck with a Budweiser,
yeah,
you know, getting hammered, killing an animal, pissing on it, and then going home.
Yeah.
You know, that's couldn't be further from the truth when it comes to like actually, you know, the vast majority of sportsmen and women that are out there, you know, and by trumpeting that to the world and showing the world like how we care about conservation, how we care about the, you know, what we harvest, how we treat it, how, like my elk that I harvest, you know, well, I won't this year because I don't have a tag, but, you know, in all the prior years, that elk lasts me a year, you know, and, the fish or the lobster, whatever, you know, I take great care to use as much of it as possible and to share it and to talk about it. Mm-hmm. And when you do that, then you get people interested, like, oh, it isn't Yosemite Sam, you know, out there, just like some jerk who's disrespecting everything and killing everything that he sees. I actually understand. Maybe I'm interested in that now. And then all of a sudden, then you slowly start, you know, the gravitational pull of that interest starts pulling things together and can create that community that that will end up, you know, helping you in the future, you know.
I still think it's so wild that one invitation to go on a boat, one invitation to go duck hunting, one invitation to go fly fishing could absolutely change somebody's life. For sure. You know, it's still so wild to me that you could have that. And it, I mean, obviously, like, it could be golf or it could be surfing or like any of those things too. But I do think so many people crave something that they don't know what they're looking for. And then all of a sudden they go fly fishing for the first time. And everything connects. And it's like, this is what I need to do, you know? And I think that that is a really exciting part. And I've talked about this too, but I think it's a byproduct of being in Southern California that the craving intensifies. It's one of those things where, because we're sitting in traffic every day, that we need something else. Like we need... And so that's why I think I decided that I wanted to get into big game hunting, because after a while I was like, I just want to be on the side of a hill with nothing happening.
Mm-hmm.
Absolute silence, no cell phone service, just sitting here. And if I happen to have my bow next to me, that's awesome.
And that, you know, that calm comes with experience as well, you know, because the first time you go out, you're all amped up. Like, oh, I got to do it. I got to do it. Well, okay, the next time you go out, then maybe that comes down a little bit because you've been there. You've done it before. And then, you know, after, you know, it's, I guess it's probably different for everybody, but after a certain amount of seasons, then you start recognizing it is, you know, recognizing things for what they are. Like, oh, this is actually a really good sort of a meditative thing to do. You know, like it, you know, when I'm sitting on the side of a mountain behind glass, you know, staring at miles and miles and miles, you know, and then you start getting cross-eyed because you're picking apart every little bush that you see. Really what you're doing is you're calming yourself and centering yourself, and, you know, and same thing goes for spearfishing. You know, I used to come home from spearfishing a lot because, like, you know, after you dive for a while, like, you start not pulling this trigger as much, right?
Yeah.
And you start becoming a lot more selective. I start coming home without any fish, and she's my ex-girlfriend. She's like, man, you're not really good at spearfishing. Like, no. I can kill a lot of fish. I just, you know, yeah. I was just dying. I didn't really see any that I wanted to get. She's like, yeah, sure. Whatever, guy. Okay. Next time I came back with a full stringer. I'm like, here you go. Time to clean them. Yeah. And so, you learn that, you know, it's the old cliche, you know, it's more about the journey than the destination.
Yeah.
And that has pretty big ramifications when you're talking about, you know, the stuff we do. Yeah. It's cool.
So you spend a lot of time teaching people, but, and encouraging people, especially in that beginning stage. But what are some of the things that you personally like still struggle with in spearfishing and hunting? Like, is it balancing like personal life and
for sure,
you know, all that stuff?
Yeah, luckily I'm in a good situation now, like with personal life. You know, I have a pretty good support network between my girlfriend, my daughter, my family. They all are really encouraging and like, oh yeah, go do it. You know, absolutely. We know you, like, go have fun.
Yeah.
So that's always been, you know, well, up until recently, it's been a difficult thing to balance. With hunting, I would say, with both sports, hunting and spearfishing, you know, in my career, I'm pretty driven, right? So it's forcing myself to get away from work to go and do, you know, the sport.
Yeah.
You know, because I know, like this Sunday, one of my friends texted me today and he's like, hey, I heard there's some yellowtail at the island. And I'm like, yeah. He's like, you want to go this weekend? And in my head, I'm thinking, oh, I got all this stuff to do. I got to do this. And then I know if I just have to say yes.
Yeah.
And then when I'm on the boat and we're running out there, I'm like, gosh, I'm glad I said yes.
Oh, totally.
It's that separating yourself. And, you know, I know it's what I've been preaching this whole time is like, get out there and do it. But it's a big difference, you know, to actually make the leap of saying yes and doing it. And that, for me, that's a difficult thing to force myself to do, even though it is my favorite thing to do.
Yeah. I think I feel that because in life, there's so many more goals to have, you know, and for me, like, there's been like a really big goal over the last few months to be like, not more physically in shape, because it's not even that, but it's finding that like right balance of where like I feel good. And so I've been running a lot more, you know, and it's one of those strange things that has nothing to do. Obviously, running is cool to a lot of people, but it's definitely not one of those things that I'm like seeking attention at, which I love. Like, it's awesome. But in that sense, it's one of those things that like is totally outside of work. It's outside of personal relationships with other people. It's outside of passion. It's outside of doing this. There's hardly any time to do it. Therefore, but I have to make that time.
You have to
spend an hour going out and running and coming back and being like, okay, like I'm a much better version of myself now that I ran than if I stayed at home and watched TV or, you know, whatever it is. And yet, like, it's so easy to hold all those things on your plate and say like, okay, I can't go because I have a week, a wedding in 2 weeks, and I need to be ready for that. And I'm not quite ready. And I have to change my oil and I have to, I don't know, whatever little chores like pop up, little things pop up. And then all of a sudden it's 8 months later and you still haven't
never did it.
You never did it.
You're like, yeah.
I've been wanting to do this for so long, and all of a sudden, you know, deer season passes you by and you're like, yeah, I didn't even get out there.
You have the tag in your pack, but you never took, put the pack on. Yeah. There's a certain selfishness to our sport as well, right? Like, you know, you go on a, you know, fishing or diving to a lesser extent, you know, but, you know, let's say you want to go like Sunday, I'm going to go to Cat on Sunday.
Yeah.
And I'm going to be gone from like 4 a.m. till dark, right? Yeah. Or hunting, you know, like I'm going to go, when I go to Wyoming this year to help a buddy with the tag, I'm going to be gone for 7 days. Mm-hmm. And there's a certain level of like selfishness to that, that I struggle with, like, oh, I have all these obligations and these relationships and I'm taking myself out of that, those things and You know, so there maybe is like this sense of guilt mm-hmm. that you're taking yourself away for such long periods of time. And with the club, with the Spiros, one thing that I tried to help the club and the members do with that is to, like, a little bit easier with spearfishing, was to find ways to involve those that you're feeling guilty for. Mm-hmm. So like, oh man, I should be hanging out with my girlfriend today, but I went diving instead and she's giving me hell about it. Well, involve her. She doesn't want to dive? Fine. Does she like to cook? No. Okay. Does she like to eat? Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, prepare that thing. Make it nice. Make her excited for you to bring that thing back, or make her excited to, you know, to cook the fish or whatever. Just find a way so that it's not just you.
Yeah.
That you can involve those around you, you know, like, to, so that, that it's not to help, like with me, it helps me with the feeling of guilt that I'm taking myself away for so long. Yeah. Hunting, especially, man, you know, like when you've got an elk tag in your pack and the season's 2 weeks long and that's all you got, you know, you, sometimes it's, hey,
yeah,
see you in 2 weeks.
It's a very interesting thing. But as you're talking about like body position and, hunting and like not having too strong of a hunting position in the water, let's say, because fish can read that. I also, though, think that in life, sometimes you have to take on the fact that we're hunting and fishing, we are becoming predators. You know, you have to step into what a predator is, and if you think about that, it's selfish.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're never going to be, like, even with like target panic and like things like that, when people are like, I don't know, I just like, I can hit the thing that I want. And like at some point, I think you literally have to be like, I'm going to kill this animal.
You have to have a killer spirit. You have to have that killer sense.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean like you're American Psycho.
Oh, totally. Totally.
You know, like you're throwing chainsaws at, you know, like, no, it doesn't mean that. It just means like you have to know something's going to die at the end of this.
Yeah. But that starts with the moment of getting in the truck.
Right.
You know, it starts
That's why I say do it right. Yeah. Treat it with respect.
Yeah.
You know, not only are you putting yourself in a situation where you may bring yourself harm, but if everything goes right, something is going to die.
Yeah.
Like I usually think, like when I go on a hunt or when I go out, like, especially if I'm chasing bigger game in the, like if I'm chasing tuna or something like that, I always think like, there's something swimming around right now that will be dead this afternoon,
mm-hmm.
you know? Mm-hmm. And so, and it's going to be my responsibility.
Yeah.
And so not just, you know, do everything right to keep yourself safe. But then once you got that harvest, do everything you can to use it. You know, like I would do, I would put on for the Spiros, I would put on like cooking classes where it showed how to use every last bit of a lobster, how to use like, oh, okay, it's halibut season. How do you use that halibut with as little waste as possible? You know, yellowtails, the same thing. We would do all these things to where you weren't wasting anything because that thing died for you, you know? Right. And that's fine because we're omnivores. Yeah. We eat meat. Things have to die.
I was at a Trader Joe's last year and I was buying like a bunch of stuff that made it look like I was going to eat a pulled pork sandwich. And the guy was like, oh, what are you making? And I was like, we're making a bluefin collar, like bluefin tuna collar. And he's like, ooh, carnitas of the deep. And it was just like knew. One of those fun, he totally knew.
He knew,
like
yeah.
He knew how good that was. And Beaver smoked it and like had this whole thing and it was so good.
Yep.
And then, you know, a big part of me, like for tuna especially, I made a ton of like tuna jerky or mm-hmm. tuna candy, whatever you want to call it. Same thing. We made a lot of like fish dip, mm-hmm. stuff like that. It's like changing the way you think of like, okay, I have 60 pounds of sushi now.
Yeah. Yeah. That it's not just that. Yeah. Lobsters, like during lobster season, you don't just have tails. You have stock, you have, you know, you have little leg poppers. You have all this stuff that, you know, like all winter long, we're eating ramen all the time. And it's because I'm making the lobster stock. We're boiling the shells, awesome. Shells down.
Yeah.
You know, Peter Yee, if you ever watch him, every tuna that he kills, you'll see it about a week later, he's smoking the tuna's head.
Yeah.
You know, like who smokes a tuna head? It's like, well, you got to think that way, you know?
But I think in that sense, it is funny because we don't need that food, but what it does is it brings in a higher respect of the animal and the process and what you just did. And in my head, I do this because I truly believe that going into the outdoors, facing the risk and reward of actually hunting and fishing is going to make you a better person. Like
it's the discipline that comes along with it. Yeah. You know, the cow elk that I shot last year, shot her across a ravine, and to pack her out, took my brother and I each two trips, 2.5 miles each way, 2,100 feet of elevation gain lost each time. So we were just hammered. You know, it took us all day to do it. Just beat. Very next morning, drove all the way back from Wyoming home. And the last thing I wanted to do was process an elk.
Yeah.
But you got to have that discipline. Yeah. And I spent the next day butchering that elk, you know, breaking it down, making my sausage, making my ground, making my cuts, making my back straps, packaging it all up, filling the freezer. And, you know, it's that whole process of like, okay, so now throughout the rest of the year from October to October.
Yeah.
Now I know that like, I'm going to cook this right. I'm going to take care of it. I'm not wasting any of it because I work my ass off for it. Right. I'm going to have to do it again.
Right.
You know,
there's a certain side of, hunting, you know, let's say you go duck hunting, same kind of thing where you wake up for here. It's like 1 a.m. Super early, hunt all day, get home at 8. You have, let's say, 4 ducks and you're like, I'm too tired. I can't clean these. And then the next day it comes. And like some people leave their ducks overnight. And normally that's actually in cold climates. But you can technically, I guess, leave the duck. But then you wait the next day. Then you put it in the fridge. And then you wait 2 more days. And then you're like really questioning like, wait, is this still good or is this not? And it's one of those like weird things where you're like, you spent all this time. You went 98% of the way and then you stopped.
Yeah.
And it actually, like, obviously butchering an elk takes a lot more time than a duck, but it's a part of what you signed up for. It would be like running 25 miles out of a marathon and being like, that's far enough.
Well, and maybe it's just changing that mindset. Maybe it's not thinking of, you know, killing the duck is 98%. Maybe it's the mindset of killing the duck. Now I'm a third of the way through the process.
Yeah.
You know, 1/3 kill, 1/3 process, 1/3 eat.
Yeah.
You know, and then it seems like a smaller hill to climb, but you just got to force your way through. It's like, you know, you get up in the morning, like you say, 1 a.m. to go, or if, you know, you're fishing or whatever, and you got to be at the boat at, you know, 4 a.m. or whatever, you're just miserable, right? Yeah. Like, oh, this sucks. But then you know that in an hour or two, you're going to be like the happiest person in the world.
Totally.
You know, it's just like having the mental fortitude to get through that and just the training and the experience, like, and it's not like somebody's training you. It's just through time, you're training yourself to accept those things. And that's part of all of this. There's no, you know, Steve Rinella hasn't made a career out of hunting by, you know, 1 or 2 days a year, walking to, you know, a quarter of the way up a mountain and suddenly an elk walks out in front of him. And it's not how it works. He's, you know, he's tramping all the time, working all the time. It's so badass because it's really hard.
Totally.
It's embrace the suck, you know, like embrace how hard it is. Know that that is not a part of it. It is the part of it.
Right.
That's why it's so cool.
Totally. I 100% agree because it is very easy to pull a trigger.
Mm-hmm.
It is really hard to be a hunter
mm-hmm.
and to do it right, you know, and that's the whole mindset of what I guess we're preaching at this point is saying like, in order to have this title, you have to go to this degree,
mm-hmm.
you know, and I really respect the people that do a lot of cooking on Instagram. Like there's this one guy, I can't remember his name right now, but he'll make like some of the best looking food and it's all with venison or pheasant or things like very, like most of the time you think of like, okay, I have venison, I'm going to make a steak
mm-hmm.
or something.
Mm-hmm.
But this is like some wild soup with like 8 different ingredients and like spent, you can tell like all day trying to like make it just right. And to me, seeing that is like, if I could give that to my friends and family, you know, over this animal that I just got to harvest, like, that is the most beautiful experience,
for
you know,
sure,
I could give. But like I said, I think a lot of, you know, I asked somebody this the other day, but like, what would fishing and hunting look like if we couldn't take photos of it at all, you know, of just like shot an elk, didn't matter how big of a rack it had.
Yeah.
Couldn't take a photo of it.
That was my grandpa.
Yeah.
I mean, that's how we grew. We didn't have cell phones. We didn't, like, he wasn't bringing a Polaroid. It was like,
yeah,
we spent all these years in Colorado killing elk and deer that I don't have any pictures of.
Right. You
know? I just know we had freezers full of them. And I know that the racks are sitting up around the ranch somewhere, you know, yeah, hanging off of stuff.
Yeah.
But it's a catch-22, right? Because I think that without the social media reach that's out there now, mm-hmm, the sport wouldn't be growing. And I mean, it's actually not growing. It's on the decline right now. Yeah. It may feel like it here in Southern California, but nationwide, you know, the number of hunters are, mm-hmm, are declining. But it's all about just like ethically preaching. It's and preaching may be the wrong word. I guess it's more like proselytizing, right? Like, mm-hmm, go out there and tell people.
Yeah.
And by involving them in it, in some little aspect of it, like you said, the beautiful thing of making this delicious meal for your family and friends, mm-hmm, that can eat it, that's involving them in it. That's, yeah, them thinking in the back of their mind, ooh, I can't wait till he goes again next time. And maybe after a year or two of that, they think, well, I want to go try that too. And then they can start learning along with it. I mean, I'm teaching a friend right now how to hunt, who, you know, he's done some high fence before, but he's never done any DIY.
Yeah.
And that bastard has never put in for a tag in his entire life. And he drew my Wyoming tag this year somehow, yeah, randomly. But yeah. So I'm having the process from basically zero teaching him up. And I'm lucky because he's a really willing participant. But it's, yeah, like, he got it. He understood. He was looped in. And now he's like, I want to try it.
Yeah.
That's just how we do it.
Yeah.
You know?
I think that in that sense, to me, I would love to go on just trips with people. Like, mm-hmm, weirdly enough, like, the experience of being, okay, it's your turn up. There's a lot of times with Zach with his boat last year where it's like, who's diving in? Mm-hmm. Well, it's like, I'll dive in. I have a GoPro, though, and I would rather film somebody else,
yeah,
dive than to try to get that animal myself. If that fish comes on the boat, that's a win no matter what. And it wasn't like a sheepish thing. Like, it wasn't like me being like, oh, I don't want to do this. But it's like, to some people, it might mean more.
Well, you've bridged that gap,
yeah,
of like the doing it for your first time and thinking that the whole thing is the shot.
Right.
Like, you've bridged that already. You know that it's the journey. Like, you're, yeah, you're having fun with the journey.
Yeah.
That's really commendable, really respectable.
And, I was really sad because the one thing that I really wanted to film was like a big school of Dorado swim by. And like the one day that we were out, it just like was one of those days, like the Dorado never got close enough. It was, like, you could tell, like,
they'd been pressured.
It was after like 2 weeks of it just being like, yeah, all out madness.
They're pressured.
Yeah. And so they are always staying like pretty far away. And I was like, man, like, I just think that they look cool. You know, like, seeing them underwater and like seeing all of them. Like,
oh, we got there right at the beginning of that last year. And those fish would swim up and like headbutt you. Like, they didn't know what the heck they were doing. You know, they were so insane. It was like, you know, boat limits in an hour, you know, it was just, yeah, like, okay, time to go home, I guess.
Yeah. Be like, these fish basically are jumping in the boat and here we are.
It got to the point where like the third Dorado trip I took last year, I was only taking shots where I thought I'd have a good chance of doubling up.
Yeah.
Like, I wasn't taking single fish shots. I was waiting for like two of them to line up. You know, it was like, I got to make some sort of sport out of it.
Yeah.
You know? But that was another season where, you know, a lot of people really found out about the sport and loved it. Yeah. Why? Because think of how many fish taco parties there were.
Oh, 100%.
You know, like, yeah, my neighborhood, we had a party at my house, you know, like, yeah, had my neighbors over, and like, how many packages of it are in my neighbor's freezers, you know? Like, and a lot of people will look down on them and say it's wasteful to take more, mm-hmm, than what you personally can eat. I don't think that I'm going to go over to like somebody I've never talked to in the neighborhood and be like, hey, I got, you know, 200 pounds of bluefin. I don't know what to do with. Here's, yeah, will you take 10? Like, it's not like that, but it is something. There is a community to it, you know, and that just builds and builds and builds a sport.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's awesome. Okay, so challenges, but what maybe are some of your goals over the next, even like 5 to 10 years? Because obviously you've been doing it now for quite some time. Like, what is your hope for the next 5 years in both hunting and spearfishing?
I've got pretty low aspirate. Like, my bar is pretty low.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not a trophy hunter. Like, I like getting racks. I think it's, when I get them, I Euro mount them and I like them.
Yeah.
But I'm a meat guy. Like, for over the next, if this year it's not going to happen because I don't have a tag, but if over the next 5 years I could just draw a tag and have meat in the freezer,
mm-hmm.
For me, that would be a successful 5 years. I'd be very happy with that.
Yeah.
My brother lives out of state, and that means that if one of us is drawing a tag every year, we get, spend a good amount of time hanging out with each other. So that's just the added bonus. One like special trip that we're trying to put together is he found a moose hunt opportunity in, Alaska that we're trying to put together.
Mm-hmm.
That would be really cool.
Awesome.
As far as spearfishing goes, I really want to go chase big halibut,
like big, in Alaska style,
like big halibut, like go up there with Dornelis.
Who was it that did that like 2 years ago?
Like
the Rife.
Yeah. John Dornelis. Yeah. He got the world record up there in Nome. I think it was about 2 years ago. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And, I would really, really like to chase big halibut.
What is it that, like...
They're such a weird fish. They're just so weird.
Do they hide themselves when they're that big, or they just don't care?
Yes and no. But, I mean, they're not hiding from predators, They're hiding to feed. But at a certain point, you got a barn door laying on the bottom.
Totally.
You see a barn door laying.
Well, like a 300-pound, my dad's caught quite a few halibut from Alaska, just rod and reel style. But, obviously like you can catch like a 300-pound halibut. Like, what is that eating? Just ling cod?
Yeah.
Like swimming by?
Yeah. 30-pound lings. Yeah. They're just beasts. Just laying on the bottom and
It's like a grouper mouth at that point, just swallowing things in.
And with nasty halibut teeth. Because those things, man, I can attest. I got bit by one of those one time and it was not...
Okay, so if you shoot it with a spear gun, halibut, I saw some sort of diagram of what a halibut brain looks like. But they are so hard to kill. Like, even a tiny one. Like, a 22-inch...
The first one I ever shot. I was diving... I don't remember who I was with. But the very first halibut I shot... I don't know. I mean, I know the triangle, right? Like,
right.
If you don't know the triangle, you draw the equilateral triangle between... From eye, looking down on the top of the head, from eye to eye, and then wherever that imaginary point is in the middle, that's where the brain is.
Yeah.
Well, the halibut doesn't work. So the very first one I shot, he wasn't huge. I mean, he's probably, 26, 28 inches or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm on the water and I shot him maybe in 2 or 3 feet of water. And so I'm standing up at this point, like this fish is flopping and I'm stabbing it in the head. I'm like, stab, stab, stab. And it didn't do the shiver, but it stopped fighting. And I'm like, good enough.
Yeah.
So I put him on my stringer that I had on my belt and I was going to look for my second one. About 20 minutes later, that thing woke up and bit me straight on the butt. I thought I was being attacked by a shark, man. I was like, oh my God. I leapt out of the water and this thing is just like attached to my butt. Tore a hole in my wetsuit. Yeah, no, those guys. So now basically I just rip out their gills and, because they're going to bleed out. I don't know where their brains are. I don't think they have brains. They're just evil beasts to bite. Now the safest thing for me now is just rip out their gills and let them bleed out there. Man, they're not going to live.
I just love it's so brutal how catching those big halibut, they like shoot them with handguns or shotguns or all sorts of
when they get them up to the boat. Yeah.
Because you can't like bring that fish onto the deck and have it be going wild.
No, especially not if it's got 3-4 shafts sticking out of it.
Oh, totally.
Flapping all over the place.
Have you seen those videos? I think it happened to Christian Seekus last year, but he posted about it like a month ago where a bluefin was on the deck and it just slammed.
No.
Hit him in the crotch and he's like,
But like they, with the shaft or the fin?
The just its tail fin just like came up and
oh my god,
gave him a nice little
yeah bluefin. I'm working right now. I've almost got it done to submit to FII, but working on a curriculum on how to hunt them. And one of the main things is just stay away until you know they're dead. Like they're no joke.
Yeah,
you know, and bringing a hot bluefin on deck, no way, man. Any big bluefin that I didn't think was dead, I would at least tail wrap and drag backwards for a while because there's just no way.
BD Outdoors just posted a photo like 2 days ago or a video where a guy kayak fishing and he catches a yellowfin tuna, and it was like a big yellowfin. I'm like, how did he get that up to the boat, right? But he gaffs it probably with those little like 2 foot and it is unbelievable. It thrashed looks him. Like a full Yamaha 150 is attached to his kayak. Just like, and his boat like literally gets a wake on it. It's like unreal. And I think he ended up just letting his gaff go because he couldn't hold on to it.
Yeah, there's no way.
You know, it's too much to hold on to, but I was laughing so much because you're like, yes, this is so epic. And then...
Yeah, what do you do at that point? It's like, what do you do? You just cut your line and be like, I can't land him, so I may as well let him go. You know, like,
yeah.
That's crazy.
Old man in the sea style.
Yeah.
Well, there's a guy last year that caught a marlin on a kayak. I don't know what ever happened to him, but...
Yeah, ask Hemingway. He'll tell you all about it.
But, yeah, halibut, that would be awesome. I mean, that's probably the challenge, though. It's like what you're talking about with bluefin, but like with halibut, you have to learn the challenge. You have to learn...
Yeah, it's the ice cold diving.
Totally.
It's the whole thing. It's so different than here. I mean, that's... really like to figure that out. Daniel Mann also, I mean, he's got a couple cool videos where he was in Norway shooting those big, really big halibut.
How deep is it when you're diving for them?
The halibuts?
Uh-huh.
I mean, I from what I understand, they're like in those big ones are like at the 40 to 60 foot depth. Yeah. Okay. So not crazy deep.
Not crazy.
Mm-mm.
Yeah.
That's I mean, most halibut I've ever shot, like here in California, no... Like 90% of them were 7 feet and shallower. Like,
yeah.
So they're just sitting in the surf line.
Totally.
But yeah, that's what just totally different over there.
Uh-huh. That would be cool. That would be really like, that's one of the things that I like about you though, is it's just like your adventures are real.
It's like the stupid things.
Well, I don't know how to like say it because it's like, in fishing, everything, for the most part, feels like a DIY over-the-counter tack. You mm-hmm. know, like, you are the captain of your boat. It's up to you to figure out where the fish mm-hmm. are going to be, how to get them, all that stuff. And the ocean is obviously, most people think it's very calm. Most people think it's very, you
empty.
Know, empty, yeah. enjoyable. Like, you yeah. are just there with your boat chasing fish. But, like, as you know, the more days you spend out on the water, it feels probably anything but that.
Oh, gosh.
You know, it's not simple at all. It's
right.
very, very complex. But, like, in Southern California, it's just one of those things that, like, you got to do something like that once in your life where it's, like, a moose hunt in Alaska.
Yeah.
Or, like, diving in ice-cold water. Like... We do get wild, but we don't get that wild in Southern California.
Yeah, yeah, we've got it pretty good here. You know, they always say like, I remember when I got scuba certified when I was whatever 16 or something like that. Like, oh, if you get scuba certified in California, you can dive anywhere in the world.
Yeah.
When I'm teaching level one classes, you know, for FII, I say something similar. Like, yeah, it's really technical diving here. Like, if you can get certified here, it's pretty hard. But I'm not taking into account places like where, you know, I'm taking into account where 98% of the world is actually going to attempt to dive.
Right.
You know, like nobody's going to go to Nome, you know, like how many people go to Nome and chase halibut, right? Like that's way harder than diving here. But I'll still say that because I know that the vast majority of people are not going to to Alaska looking for halibut. You know?
That's awesome. Yeah. But there's... you know, in the sense of Alaska's tagline of like the last frontier, it's yeah. like one of those things that it's just one of, not everybody needs to do it, but at the same time, it's just one of those like really cool things to have that on the radar and yeah. say like, oh, this is a possibility. And
it's part of the, it's all community too. Cause like I never would have known or thought to do if I, you know, didn't know John.
Yeah.
It's like, I've got a connection up there between, you know, Darvel McBride and John Dornelis, you know, they're like between them, that's how I'm going to get there. I'm not just going to go and be like, okay, I can dive pretty well down here in California and just wrap up my gear and run to Alaska and start diving. Like, no, it's the community. It's the local knowledge. It's the, you know, being able to be tapped in to different places.
Mm-hmm.
It's so important. It's like the important thing.
Totally. Could you ever live in Alaska, do you think?
I think I'd have to be, maybe as I got a little older, I could. I think right now I still like a lot of community, like a lot of people. And, you know, it's pretty sparse up there.
Yeah.
But I think I could, I think maybe like right now, similar to my thought process in Oregon, maybe if I had a place up there, I could spend time up there.
Yeah.
I don't know about full time.
I could see you like Ranella having like a summer house up in Alaska.
I would love to do that. My brother and I have talked about it. Yeah. Yeah. The fish camp, you know, the Ranella's fish camp.
Exactly.
Yeah. I would love to do that.
It's funny, man, I think it was the owner of Black Rifle. They go out, and they're going fishing, I think just for halibut or something. Some really simple out of the fish camp. And then like this torrential downpour happens and you're like, just like, wait, I thought fish camp was like fun time. Yeah. It's like, no.
Well, I can tell you. Yeah. I mean, anytime you're, you know, anywhere up there north, you know, Wyoming this, it was last year. We were, Jeff and I, my brother, we went up for archery season for our elk and, weather forecast, everything was great. You know, it wasn't supposed to be any sort of real precipitation, anything like that. And it was supposed to be cold at night, but fine during the day. And all, you know, we were, I don't remember how many days we were packed in, but on the last day we were packed in, we were up on this ridge and looking out over this long, deep valley, like forever valley, miles and miles and miles and miles. And I'm looking, I see this black cloud. And I'm like, Jeff, what's that? He's like, it's way over there. So we sat and we watched it for a while and it looked like it was moving in a different direction. All right. So we go back and we're actually on a bowl. Like we found, like we located him with sound. We had a really good idea, you know, which pocket he was in. So we're calling him and bugling at him and, you know, he's bugling back and he's getting fired up. We're getting fired up and we're getting closer, closer. And I'm looking over my shoulder and I'm like, hey Jeff, look at that cloud. And that was closer and closer. And we didn't have rain gear, you know, didn't have anything with us. We were like 3.5 miles from camp. And between us and camp was 100% deadfall. It was just 100% deadfall. And that cloud came and next thing you know, it was on top of us.
Yeah.
And so I had my tarp that I lay down to like when I'm quartering the animals to lay it on before we put it in the bags. I had that. So we tied that to a tree to keep ourselves out. We're tucked up like shivering next to each other waiting. Like, okay, it's going to pass, going to pass, going to pass. Well, I'm looking at my watch. We have like 2 hours until dark and it's still raining. And I'm like, Jeff, we got 3.5 mile hike to do and we only have 2 hours to do it. And it's all deadfall.
Yeah.
He's like, you're right. We got to go. So we start going. And that was like, I think that was in the field. I think that was one of the only times that I asked myself, like, is this going to be it? Because both of us, you know, we were having to keep up a pace enough to where we kept ourselves warm.
Yeah.
But not so fast we were being dangerous because it was all deadfall. My brother's, you know, he's 6'5", probably 210 pounds. Like, and I kept telling him, like, dude, if you fall and you get hurt,
I can't carry you.
I can't.
Yeah.
And like, even me, like, he's a big, strong kid, but, you know, I'm like 185. You know, if I fall and get hurt, you can't. So, like, so we were having to, like, keep that balance of, you know, like, are we going to be safe? Are we going to be not? And, you know, luckily we made it back. We made it back after dark and we were just in a, you know, a floorless teepee. We had a little, you know, one of those stoves in there, the Seek Outside stoves. We got that thing lit and we're like, okay, everything's going to be good now. And then after it starts warming up, you see our clothes just, it's like sauna, just steaming off of us. Well, you ever been in one of those teepee tents?
Just complete condensation. That is
now it's raining on us inside. And so we've got our sleeping bags and it's raining on the sleeping bags and it's raining outside. oh my gosh. And I thought, you know, and now the temperature's dropped and it dropped to like 33 degrees.
Yeah.
I'm like, please just get cold. Like, please just snow, stop. And it never did.
Yeah.
And that was the last day of that hunt. You know, next day we got up and we're like, screw this, we're going home.
I had one of the only times that I went fly fishing as a college student. After college, I started fishing more because I had a car up there and I was able to like actually have money and drive around and do all that fun exploration type stuff in Washington. But when I was a college student, my friend was like, hey, you want to go fly fish? I don't know why. It was in the middle of January. Maybe in his head, he thought we were going to go for steelhead. We definitely weren't going to go for trout. Like, it just wasn't that. And normally I always check the weather. Like, one of my favorite things in life is like checking weather and some
knowing what's coming,
knowing like what to expect, right? Well, we are leaving Seattle and it's completely downpouring. Like you said, the Pacific Northwest normally is misty.
Yeah.
It's not downpouring,
yeah,
but it's downpouring.
Yeah. Seattle will get those heavy rains.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so we are going up into like the Yakima area and we get to where we're going and it's kind of snowing. It's like 30, like you said, 33 degrees right on that like super, super heavy thing. Okay, not a problem. We'll set up the tent. Everything's still in the car. It's going to be dry. Well, the tent had a leak in it.
Oh, no.
So everything, absolutely everything got soaked. And so it went from being like an okay situation, all right, we'll be a little cold, to being like,
this is a problem.
This is really bad because now nothing, our down sleeping bags are wet.
Yep.
Our jackets are wet.
Yep.
Socks are wet.
No way.
We can't change.
No way to dry out because everything outside's wet.
I've never been like more excited to wake up in the morning than that day. And so I think I woke up at like first light, like absolutely the grayest light possible. Yeah. Woke up. Started making coffee. My friend wakes up shortly after that. And I think we just had like a little burner, like MSR burner, like whatever, nothing special. And it had like a little percolating coffee thing on it. Somehow he like kicks it over. And I was like, that's it. We're going home.
Your hot, like, your hot coffee just got ruined.
Like the last little bit of warmth that I could possibly
find. That's the sign. But hey, that's all part of the, you know, filing it away, filing it away. You have to do it. Like, you have to do it. And you went back again afterward, right?
Yeah, like, totally.
That's the best part about it.
And to some degree, I think it's a very mild way understanding that the weather could change on you at any moment.
Sure.
You know, it's obviously those situations do come up. And the more you're in the mountains, the more it's going to happen. You know, it's like, the weather looks great. It's the middle of summer. Like, why would it be like this?
Until
and then
it
all
does.
Of a sudden it's snowing on you.
Until it
and
does.
You're like, all right.
Yeah.
Well, I guess one of my favorite, not favorite books, because it's not like a literary thing, but it's a really fun thing to read, is this book on this guy that just does like the volunteer search and rescue stuff out in Mammoth.
Uh-huh.
And the amount of stories of like things going south quickly in the middle of summer is like the whole thing of that book, you know, and just being like, all right, so we're out hiking up in Tioga Pass in Yosemite and somebody gets hurt. All of a sudden it's below 30 degrees, you know, what would have been like an easy day turned into like an absolute rescue.
Yeah. It turned into hell. Yeah.
And really bad to worse. And so it's one of those like things, like, I mean, that is why you do it.
Yeah.
Like to some degree, it's like, you know, when you're leaving your boat, like leaving shore and you're just like going out into the middle of nowhere, it's like, you do get that sinking feeling of like, what if something went wrong?
I was diving Eagle Reef one day and the current was ripping, had my boat on anchor. And I was with a guy that I never just met him. I was actually giving him a ride back from a campsite. And he was a friend of a friend, and my friend vouched for him. Mm-hmm. He's like, yeah, he's a good guy. I'm all right. It's cool. Way back, I'm like, you want to dive? He's like, yeah, let's dive. So we stopped off at Eagle Reef, and we were seeing if we could find there's some good current. And he kind of disappeared. I couldn't find him, right? Yeah. And I was staying next to the boat because we didn't have a float to mark us. So I was using the boat as my float.
Yeah.
And next thing you know, I hear this like clinking noise. Oh, so first the wind picked up, which it wasn't supposed to. Picked up kind of gnarly. And then all of a sudden I hear like in the water, I hear this clink, 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 clink. I'm like, what the heck is that? Yeah. And I look back and the boat is gone. Uh-huh. Like the boat is being blown away.
Uh-huh.
I'm like, son of a... I look around and I'm like, where's he at? Where's he at? And I couldn't find him. I'm looking around. I'm like, well, I can keep looking for him or I can get the boat and look for him. So I bailed and I swam for the boat. I swam like a half mile to catch the boat.
Yeah.
And then luckily I had left the... on my GPS, I had left the tracker on.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, it was tracking the boat as it was floating away.
Yeah.
So I pulled the anchor back up, you know, got it, you know, used the windlass, got it back up, followed my track back slowly. And, you know, like the neck by this time, there's, you know, this crazy wind chop. There's white caps everywhere. And I'm like, how am I ever going to find this guy?
Yeah.
And just luckily I see one of his fins, like he was so oblivious. I see one of his fins come up in the air to make a drop. Way. And I'm like, oh, yeah. There he is. He never even like realized it. You know, the boat was gone. He didn't know I was gone. He was like, yeah, I never saw any fish. How about you doing? I'm like, oh, yeah. You didn't see the boat was gone? No. What happened? I'm like, oh, yeah, never mind. You'll never be on the boat again.
What would have happened? I mean, thankfully it was Cat and not maybe even SCI or something because...
Yeah, he could have swam to shore eventually. But. Yeah.
But just being like... I know a lot of people that dive on paddies alone...
From a boat. That's crazy.
Just like...
What happens if the wind turns on?
One little thing could
happen. What happens if the current turns on and you don't realize it? Next thing you know, you look and you can't catch your boat.
So I was talking to Mike Borchardt about this, about diving in Hawaii. And it's weird when you think about the math of it. But let's say you're diving down to 100 feet. The current is moving at 20 miles an hour. So you're down underwater for...
60 seconds. At minimum, 66 seconds.
Yeah. Going 20 miles an hour at 60 seconds, you're a quarter mile away.
Yeah, you're moving a lot.
So you have to stay with your friends or stay with... Like, that's far enough that you don't want to swim back.
Well, especially a lot of those Hawaii places, you can't swim back. Yeah. You know, you take the drift and you swim to shore and then you go back. You know, you get picked up.
Yeah. But it's just wild. Like, you don't think that that's happening.
Yeah.
And then, obviously, like... You could be at Shiprock. You could be like anywhere.
Shiprock gets gnarly.
multiple ways.
Yeah. Shiprock is... I always get a little like on edge at Shiprock, and not even for the sharkiness of it. There's just something about that. It's like, oh man, so many. Like especially if you go on the mainland side of the rock and anchor up over there, it's like, man, I am so close to this rock. If this wind changes right now, we're cracked up on the rocks. You know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's something to me that feels scarier than going in on a paddy for whatever reason. Like at Shiprock, it's just like, I don't know if it's the current, like you just know that
there's something there. Something weird there. Yeah. I had some friends, we were at a camping trip over there and their boat got they came off anchor at Shiprock and had to swim like a long, and actually they'd never even caught their boat. Another boat noticed.
No way.
And they were lobster diving. So it was night. Another boat noticed that something didn't look right, and they came over.
It was
over.
Like spinning somehow.
Yeah,
or something.
I don't know what it was, but they went and got the boat for them, and then found the divers. Jeez. Yeah, that was. Yeah, just know this is a crazy sport.
Yeah, my mom is always like, "I don't want to actually know what you're doing."
I've got a set of shark jaws on the wall in my house, and none of my family knows that story because it was me fighting that shark.
No way.
And it lost. Oh, man. Yeah. So like the friends know it, but the family doesn't know that one. Yeah. They just think that's a shark that I harvested to eat. We did eat it, but not why I shot
it. Was that here in California or somewhere else?
No, I was in PV.
Nice.
that was a crap show, man.
Well, we'll talk about that off air your family doesn't have
that's
to
good
know.
I'm here, have all my fingers.
Yeah, well, before you go, it's like we can talk about the diving safety really quick, and I'm gonna have Eric Jensen on
good.
In a little bit, after his competition now that it's over, but I'm going to do the more of the FII stuff with him.
Yeah.
and all that stuff. But it's funny because for me, like, I grew up like snowboarding and like being in the mountains, and obviously we talked about the weather changing and stuff, but it's one of those like weird things where like people think, like, especially all the time in snowboarding, like, oh, like if they can go down that, then I can go down that. Especially on like powder days.
Yeah.
You're like, oh, like if I can, if that guy just did it, then I can do it. What's the big deal?
Yeah.
And for me, like, it's just being from being on the mountain so much, it's like I literally was on I had a plan to go to a mountain after a big snowstorm, do a certain line that day we like not chickened out, but just like it didn't line up. And then there's an avalanche and a literal, like, one of the ski patrol guys from the mountain was on his day off and like decided to ski that line, and he was the one that died. You know, it's like one of those like crazy things where like then you get somebody who's just learning how, and like, well, if they're hiking up that, then I can go up that. And you're like, you don't know like how, what transponders they have, what training they have, what like safety, like anything of that. But I say that because I think a lot of people think snowboarding's a really safe sport. Diving is one of those things that, like, I think people think it's like, oh, it's just swimming,
right? You know, it's funny. I start every class that I teach by explaining that freediving is a super safe sport as long as you follow the rules. Like, there are rules, and not like rules that are made up by man. These are rules that are made up by physiology and physics, yeah. Right? And so with the FII Level 1 class, we teach those rules. And I tell everybody, I said, this class will be your coat of armor to keep you safe. But in the same way that a coat of armor does you no good if you left it at home and you walk out to the battlefield, you know, the sword's still going to cut you.
Yeah.
If you put on, you need to put that on and you need to use it every single time you get in the water. You know, freediving is a natural thing. We are built for it, genetically built for it. Like, our body responds in very specific ways to diving that, that help us and keep us safe. But if you're not, if you don't take the time to educate yourself, and you don't, once you have that education, you don't take the, you know, you're not conscientious of those things, it's a very, very, very dangerous sport. And that's actually, you know, one of the, when you talk to the old salty guys that think that FII is ridiculous and you should just, you know, learn, or just, you know, learn on your own. My question to them is always, and I've never gotten a good answer from them. They say, well, you know, you should just learn by experience. And I'm like, okay, so you're insinuating trial and error, right? Well, yeah, of course. I'm like, okay, I understand what trial is. Can you explain to me what error is?
Yeah.
Because error is death in this sport. It's not like in this sport you're going to go out and mess up and, you know, break a wrist. You're going to go out and you're going to do something wrong and you're going to drown.
Yeah.
So my big thing that I wanted to, so I don't, Eric is going to be a much better, you know, Eric teaches all the time and he's going to be a much better interview for this, but I became an instructor just because I wanted to, like, you know, at certain times during the, like, I created the scholarship fund for OC Spiros where we pay for, you know, I think they're, we've paid for like up to 70 people's level one certification to this point. But I just really, like, I love the sport and I don't like having friends die because I've had friends die. And it's so easy not to die in the sport.
Yeah.
So just, you know, do it right. Go learn and do it right. And if you can't afford it, go to the OC Spiros and you can get a scholarship through them. They'll pay for 100% of the class. And so there's no excuses. There's no financial excuses. No excuse.
Right.
At all.
Yeah. It's just one of those things, like, I think that is so important and so available. You know,
there's a class like every, there's a class like every weekend.
Yeah.
Like,
like you said, if the air... Like, what is air? You're underwater when something bad happens. And if you could have avoided that by simply knowing one little thing.
Or having a partner with you that knows how to help you. Like, because sometimes you make a mistake, but we train how to have a partner that knows how to like, even the mistakes that you make aren't immediately life-threatening. You know, you may have a blackout and you're not, a lot of people think, oh, when I black out, I'm dead. No, you got time. As long as you have a partner there who's going to be able to assist you in the proper way in the right amount of time, you're going to be totally fine with, like, zero brain damage or anything. You're going to be fine.
Yeah.
But you have to take the time to go out and learn those things. You just have to.
Yeah. It is one of those things that you're like, you don't want to regulate anything, because obviously that we are somewhat in this like sport of it all, but you're like, I wish people could be like actually licensed to die, to do this.
Well, yeah. I mean, and if they're not, then they're taking their lives into their hands.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've known 5 people who have died,
mm-hmm.
you know, 3 of them were certified. They weren't following the rules.
Yeah.
They left their coat of armor at home. You know, they were breaking major rules when they were diving, and they died because of
mm-hmm.
it.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Well, Brad, it's been real fun talking to you, and obviously don't want to end on a bad note, but it's one of those things that I really respect what you've done for the spearfishing community down here. And also, I just love the way you do your adventures. Like, it's something that is inspiring to me, of just like, you grind it out, but you like don't real, like most people don't know it, you know.
Well, thank you, appreciate that.
Until we like Elkhart, you know, at Windward Westward, and it's like,
oh, it's the best.
So good.
It was the best. Can't wait to my next one.
Yeah. But I just appreciate it, because, you know, to me, you're a role model, whether you know it or not. But it's one of those things that, you know, the 5 years or so that I've been like in the diving community, obviously I don't dive as much as I used to, but knowing who you are and knowing like what you've done for the community down here is awesome.
That means a lot. Thank you. I appreciate you saying that. Yeah. Thanks.
Well, thanks for coming on.
All right. Till next time.